Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I am the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference hosted top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, David Friswold discusses his research on how the school breakfast program has impacted student achievement. Friswold is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Iowa.
So first, I'd like to just start off by saying thanks for the opportunity to speak, and thanks to all the conference organizers for organizing this great event. So I'm going to talk about the school breakfast program. So a lot of my interest now underlies this idea that better nourished children perform better in school. And so this is an idea that has been around for quite a long time. There's a lot of research to support this idea. And this was an idea that was important in the 1960s and was important in terms of underlying the school breakfast program. It was also important in terms of underlying the design of the Head Start program, where it was actually a pediatrician who took the lead in terms of figuring out the design of the program. And it underlies the development of food assistance programs, where there's this link between poverty and nutritional deficiencies. And so food assistance programs are trying to reduce some of the nutrition deficiencies. And so I'm going to talk about the school breakfast program, where it's a program that provides subsidized breakfast to low-income children. And most of the research on this has been related to nutritional quality. And so we have some good evidence that the availability of the school breakfast program does improve the nutritional quality of diets and meals consumed during the morning. Now, when the school breakfast program was launched in 1966, President Johnson launched it with the phrase, good nutrition is essential to good learning. Now, so that's kind of the launching point of the program. It turns out, though, there's really been very limited research on the academic or achievement outcomes of the school breakfast program. So there's been a lot of work in developing countries, a lot of work just related to the idea of breakfast consumption in general. There's been some recent work on changing where students are eating breakfast, but in terms of just expanding the availability of the program, the extent of the literature is really, there was a paper in that focused on a few schools in Massachusetts in the 80s, and so I'm trying to kind of get a more of an understanding of, is it really the case that the school breakfast program influences achievement outcomes? And so just to give kind of a sense of where the paper's going, and I'm going to provide a lot more background about food assistance for our school meal programs. So I'm going to try to leverage some state mandates that require some schools to offer breakfast and others are not required to. And the results are going to be that the availability of the program is, or at least I think, increases achievement, and it seems that it improves nutrition. So let me just give some historical context of U.S. school meal programs. Right, so this has been primarily in the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was city programs. And so a lot of the early starters that you hear a lot about are Philadelphia, Boston, Milwaukee. It expands to a handful of other cities then throughout the early 1900s into the 1920s. In coming out of, in and coming out of the Depression, federal assistance starts to begin. The school lunch program and the school breakfast program are not the first times that you hear about school meal programs. It's really just when it becomes more formalized in the federal system. And so So federal assistance takes off after the Depression in 1946. After World War II, the National School Lunch Program begins. And so I just wanted to show you, this is kind of how they thought of it in 1946. So in the beginning of the School Lunch Act, was designed as a measure of national security. Right, so the concern was about the military and whether or not people were basically able to serve. So national security, to safeguard the health and well-being of the nation's children and to encourage the domestic consumption of nutritious agricultural commodities. So there was many things that school lunches were trying to do. Then in 1966, it was a little bit different, right? So when the school lunch or the Child Nutrition Act of 1966 was launched, what they started the discussion with was what they had learned through the school lunch program, and the idea that they had learned about the benefits to children. The idea that it could improve student outcomes. Now, when it was launched, there was no discussion of national security at the time. They did mention safeguarding the health and well-being of the nation's children, and they actually did mention agricultural programs as well. That's actually a little bit less. So currently, that's less of an issue for breakfast. In fact, you actually don't have entitlement foods and bonus foods in the school breakfast program. And so then, I just wanted to contrast the difference. So when it was started in 66, the idea was that there was going to be some influence on learning. And then just to give you more sense of some of the school meal programs, 1966, the special milk program begins, and this is for schools that don't have either of the other two programs. And then we have the summer food service begins in 68, and what's now called CFP, Child and Adult something food program. yes, thank you. And that starts in 68. And so I just wanted to show you some sense of the size of these programs and how they've changed over the last bit of time, right? So here we have the school breakfast program. In terms of the amount of schools participating across the country, so it's going to go from less than 10% up to about 90%. Children participating, it was less than 1 million to 13 million. Less than 1 billion meals were served to now 2.2 billion meals served. And it cost almost $11 million in 1970. Now it's a $3 billion program. This number is not quite right. I don't know what the exact number is. But the school lunch program is now basically in almost every school. If you have a cafeteria, you participate in the school breakfast program, or sorry, school lunch program. That's not necessarily true for breakfast. School lunch is much bigger, and the expansion from 1970 forward is much smaller. Right. So just in the sense of, we're talking about 30 million children versus 13 million. So much bigger school lunch program. But the increase over time, much smaller. And so I'm going to be focusing mostly on the school breakfast program. Now, the way the breakfast program is structured is, as long as it's available in schools, everyone is entitled to a meal. The difference is just what you pay for that meal. And so the reason why there's the difference is in terms of how much the federal government reimburses the per meal cost, but also they put a cap on how much you can charge a reduced price. Students are receiving a reduced price meal. And so if your family household income is 130% or below, of poverty, then you receive a free meal. 130 to 185 is a reduced price, where for breakfast you can't pay more than 30 cents per meal. And then even above 185, there's still a small subsidy that the federal government pays on the per meal cost. And so it's now 26 cents, although this is the 2010 to 2011 just because it's a little cleaner. So it's just got a little bit slightly more complicated because of the latest reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act, and this was just a cleaner version to show. And so then just to contrast the difference, so this is going to be some of the difference in costs, is just lunch is more expensive than breakfast. So I wanted just to give kind of some example of what to think about breakfast, right? So I think that we all kind of have some different notion of what school breakfast looks like. And so I grabbed a menu. for one of these talks, so I was giving a talk a while back, and I grabbed this menu, and it's the worst week possible in the entire year, and so it's kind of useful to kind of just see this. And this is also, it's not really the best district. This is going to be a large urban district that, just to give you kind of some sense of what meals could look like. And so this, the idea is going to be the same kind of, I'll give you some sense of how this has changed over time, but the idea, you're going to have a choice of milk. You're going to have some type of fruit-related item, right? So, you know, I mean, here it's going to be some type of juice or some type of fruit, and then you're going to have some type of entree. Now, what's going to stand out here compared to how it was when it launched is there would have been very limited proteins back then, right? So the idea when it was launched was you were given 15 cents per meal, and 15 cents per meal actually didn't pay for protein. I think the official language was something like serve protein as you could, or it was recommended, but no school could ever actually have the resources to do it. So this is kind of some way that it's changed. And so I just wanted to give you kind of some sense of what to think about. And so the story is really not going to be that. So although there are set USDA guidelines, and there have always been set USDA guidelines for what the meals should consist of, the story is not necessarily going to be that you're going to school and, you know, you're walking into a giant, smorgasbord of fresh fruits that just came off the farmer's truck. It's going to be the idea that it's a relative improvement, right? So it's better than what you would have had otherwise. And so that's kind of the story with the nutritional aspect. there's this question of why might the availability of breakfast then improve nutrition? And so, improve achievement. And first, I think nutrition comes to mind, and that was actually why it was launched, right? It was this idea of nutrition. And so there's been a lot of work underlying nutrition and breakfast consumption in general, and the idea is it can enhance memory, mental concentration, and cognition. And so there's going to be differences, and some aspects are going to be more focused towards long-term cognition, and some are going to be more focused towards short-term cognition. And so this is just going to be an example of some of the different mechanisms through which nutrition can influence cognition. So we're going to have things like iodine, iron, folate are going to be more in terms of influencing long-term cognition. Things like glucose are going to be more short-term spikes. Although one of the things is that as you switch from, simple carbohydrates to high-fiber items, you're going to get basically a more sustained glucose response. So it's not as much of a short-term spike in terms of cognition benefits. So besides nutrition, though, it could just be the case that students show up to school more often as a result of breakfast consumption. Now, that can be a couple of mechanisms that could drive this. It could be the case that breakfast provides some incentive to get to school, or for parents to get their children to school because you know that they're at least getting a meal at school. That could be the case that if you're just going to be late, right, so maybe you're just always 15 minutes late, well, maybe it's better to be 15 minutes late for breakfast than 15 minutes late for first period. It also could be the case, though, that there are fewer illness-related absences. And attendance, though, it could have this interesting effect of it changes the peer composition of if there's increased attendance, it can change the peer composition of who, either who was on the bus or who was in school. And so the peer effects, it's actually not clear which way it would go. Now, there's also a potential income effect, right? So if it's not the case that it is increasing breakfast consumption, then there's an income effect because what it's doing is it's just changing which resources are used to pay for breakfast. So it's switching it from household resources to school resources. And just to kind of ballpark some of this, so if you take the federal reimbursement rate and make the assumption, which is, an assumption, that the federal reimbursement rate would be the same as what a household would pay for breakfast. That would be about $26 per month per child. So for a family at 100% of poverty, that's 3% of gross income. And just to ballpark what $26 per month per child is, well, that's 70% of the average monthly food cost per person for WIC. Now, so you can think of that a couple ways. One, maybe you could think of it as the school breakfast income effect or school breakfast amount maybe is not as small as then you would have thought, or you might think of it as the WIC payment is actually quite small. And now then, what happens with school breakfast is it's also earlier. Right? So the timing could play a role in terms of how this influences starting times at school and sleep time. So how does the school breakfast program differ from the lunch program? So timing can be an important role. And timing, what's going to do here is it's going to influence which schools participate, but also which students enroll. So this is something that, right, so the national school lunch program is different in the sense that you're already at school. And so when with the school lunch program, the per meal costs are reimbursed. And so if you're going to provide a cafeteria for students, then it's generally worth it for the school to accept the per meal reimbursement rate and to provide school lunch. For breakfast, it's a little bit different because it's prior to the start of the school day. So that can involve rearranging transportation systems. And that can complicate transportation for families, transportation for the school district. You also have to have additional staffing prior to the start of the school day. Depending on the school district, that could involve changing some of the union contracts that have start times. So there's a little bit more involved in a meal that's prior to the start of the school. Now, since it can influence which students participate, there are different demographics for the school lunch program to the school breakfast program. So just to give you some numbers, 82% of meals for the school breakfast program are either served free or reduced price. So they're served to students that are less than 185% of poverty. And that's just 2004 numbers. But basically, since 1973, it's been at least 80%. Now, that's been changing quite a bit for school lunch. So school lunch, it's actually been increasing over time, but it's still in 2004, it was only 59%, right? So it's a different demographic of the student that is going to show up to school early for breakfast than it is for the student who is going to go to lunch. And so that you might think that that influences basically the counterfactual of what students would be consuming in the absence of the program. And so school breakfast is not available in all schools, and it's actually expanded dramatically in the past 20 years. And so that's going to be somewhere that's going to be a lot of what I'll focus on in the talk. And so I'm going to talk a lot about the availability of breakfast. So one, I think that's the policy lever, and that's been the policy lever throughout most of the time of the program. Now, there's been policy attention recently to changing breakfast from the cafeteria to the classroom. But in general, most of the discussion has been on increasing access to the availability of the program in schools. There's also a nice benefit, and there's less measurement error. Right. So what happens is, in information that I can observe, schools are asked, do you participate in the USDA's school breakfast program? Which is going to be a little bit different than when you ask parents, does your child have breakfast at school? Right. So you can have breakfast at school through many different areas. You can have breakfast at school through vending machines. You can have breakfast at school through other types of competitive foods, or you can have breakfast at school through the school breakfast program, or you can actually have no idea what is going on in the schools, and you might think you're sending your child off with money that is used for something else. And, just one other way that they differ is, so this was in the very start of the program in 1966, you could have entitlement foods through the school breakfast program and bonus foods, and what I mean by these are agricultural supports, basically. And so now the entitlement foods and bonus foods are actually supposed to be just for the lunch program, although you know, you'll talk to people, and there's fungibility, right? So, as you might expect. So let me just give some kind of context of the availability of the program and how it's changed, right? So in 1966, the School Breakfast Program was launched as a pilot program. Funds were targeted towards the poorest schools and rural schools. So schools where students had to, a large travel distance. That was the idea of the targeting. It doesn't seem to be the case that that's necessarily actually how that occurred, but that was the idea behind it at the time in 66. Now, one of the things that occurs, though, is that funding was actually not sufficient to cover the cost of food, and it wasn't actually designed to be. So at first, when they just provided a set amount per meal, it wasn't covering the cost of food. But even then, they had these higher poverty schools where it was just 80% of the cost of food. So they actually did not even intend it to completely cover the cost of food. So that's going to keep availability down. Funds then expanded in the early 1970s to cover the cost of food, but not labor. And so that's further going to increase or decrease the incentive for schools to participate in the program. And so one of the things that happened was schools, at least from the histories that are written during this time, was that schools reallocated Title I funds to make up the gap. Now, that wasn't, my understanding is that it wasn't actually legal, but that was what happened. At least from some of these histories of the program. And then the school breakfast program was permanently authorized in 1975. So I just want to give you kind of some sense of, right, so this is a permanent authorization in 1975, and on the y-axis you have the percent of schools serving breakfast that also serve lunch. Right, so these are going to be schools that have cafeterias. So it's as 15% in 1965, and or 75, and then right after authorization, you see the increase, right? And so there's going to be a large increase up until 1980, and then it plateaus. Funding's basically constant. And then it increases again in the late 80s to early 90s. And that's going to be the period that's going to kind of, that I'm going to focus on. And so the idea is why that increase occur. And so, so the expansion of the breakfast program stagnates in the 80s, and the concern was that although the federal government was providing the per meal costs, they were not. There are still upfront startup costs that the schools would have to face that made it so they were reluctant to begin participating in the program. So along comes the Child Nutrition Act in 1989. And so what happened was in the Child Nutrition Act of 89 was Congress set aside funds for specifically for startup costs. And so those started in 89 all the way up until welfare reform in 96. And so what these startup costs were, the way that they were allocated was Congress said, we're going to allocate these funds to states if states could demonstrate that the funds were going to be allocated towards high poverty schools. All right, so then what you see is, so this is just focusing in on that same graph, but from 1991 to almost current. And so there's this large increase that's occurring right after that, from just below 50% to about 75%, and then it's slowly increasing a little bit after that. So in this period of startup funds being available, you get a substantial increase in schools that are offering breakfast. And so what happened was that when states had to allocate funds to high-poverty schools, what they did was they created these mandates, and these mandates would be based on defining which schools were required to offer breakfast. And they did this based off of the percent of free and reduced price eligible students in the school. And so most of these had this range of 10 to 40%, except Connecticut has an 80% threshold. And what I mean by these thresholds is just to take it as an example of Ohio. So Ohio has a 33% threshold. So what that means is when you look at the student body and who's eligible for free or reduced price meals, So if the school is going to have a school lunch, you're going to have good information about this. And once at least 33% of the student body is eligible for free or reduced price meals, then you're going to be required to offer breakfast in Ohio. But at 32%, you're not required to. That doesn't mean you can't. It just means you don't have to. And so I'm going to try to leverage some of these state mandates, and just to give you a sense of where the distribution of these mandates looks like is 7 states just require all schools to participate, 16 states require some schools to participate, and 28 don't have a requirement. All right, so just to show you what this map looks like across the country, right? So here we are. There's actually no mandate here because the way it's set up is that schools are required to offer one meal. So that basically is saying you're not required to offer breakfast, since the easier option is lunch. So one of the things you'll notice is that, the darkest states are going to have no requirement on breakfast. The lightest states are going to require all schools to offer breakfast. And the shades of gray are going to require some schools to offer breakfast. So the gray states are the right half of the country and the Pacific Northwest. So this is actually going to be different than, right, this is the idea that school breakfast is different than an agricultural support program. Right, so this is actually where I live now, and this is not gray or all white. Right, so this is not an agricultural support program. So what you see is that it's the South and Northeast that is requiring schools to offer breakfast, and it's somewhat of a switch. Right, so Connecticut of how maybe you might think about this working. Connecticut has an 80% threshold, so that means basically almost the entire school has to be eligible for free or reduced price meals before the school is required to offer breakfast. On the other end of the spectrum is Texas has a 10% threshold, right? So it's actually much lower than maybe you might think, or at least than my prior would have been going into this. But so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to leverage these gray states, and where the idea is that even within the states, some schools are going to be required and some schools are not. And the idea is that within those states, I'm going to then be trying to compare schools that have those set poverty lines, where one school is required and one's not, to another state where at those same poverty lines, both schools would be on one side of the threshold. So that's kind of the idea of what I'm going to try to do. And I'm going to do it through two ways. So first, I'm going to look at the biggest data set I can find, and I'm going to try to get a sense of how these mandates influence achievement. And I'm going to focus on fourth grade in 2003, just so I can compare it to this other data set. And I'm going to look at public school students, because the mandates apply to public schools. And I'm going to have information on 50,000 plus students. The downside is it's really just getting a sense of the mandates. So there's not information on which schools are required to offer breakfast. So then I'm going to try to get a better sense of how the availability of the breakfast program influences achievement by turning to the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study has just 3,000 observations, but it has better information as information from the principals on whether or not the school participates in the USDA school breakfast program. It has information from the students about food consumption to give me some sense of how this influences nutrition, and it has information about attendance. So one of the things that's going to come up is schools when these mandates were created and the startup funds were established, the idea was that the per meal costs are once schools are required to offer breakfast or they're incentivized to offer breakfast with these school startup fund grants, then the per meal costs are covered, so schools will continue to offer breakfast. Right, so then there's this issue of once the mandate binds, students or schools are unlikely to stop offering breakfast. So one, the startup costs are already borne, but also it's not the easiest thing to do for a principal to say, you might have thought you had a benefit last year, but we're taking it away from you this year. So it turns out in the ECLSK data, we don't see any school that stops offering breakfast once the mandate binds. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get information off of the percent of free and reduced price eligible students in the school going back to 1999 and the Common Core of Data, which is a data set from the U.S. Department of Education that covers the universe of public schools. And so I'm going to link that to these other data sets to get a sense of how the percent of free and reduced price eligible students in the school has changed since 1999. Now, and so I'm going to use the maximum percent. So basically the idea is once this mandate kicks in, then it's effective. Now I'll say these are this is eligibility counts based off of October 1, so this is not going to be reflecting students who are deciding whether or not to consume breakfast in school, or this is whether or not you're eligible. And so this is going to be the basic story of the paper. And this idea, right? So what this is you're trying to compare schools that offer breakfast to schools that don't and understand how that influences academic outcomes. Well, the problem is going to be that, as you might expect, there's going to be lots of differences between which schools offer breakfast and which schools don't, and it's going to be difficult to try to control for some of these differences. Right? So if we look at these, this is just going to be, in general, schools that are above the state threshold. Right? So these schools are all required to offer breakfast. This column is going to be schools below the threshold, so they're not required to offer breakfast. So students, 98% of students attend a school that offers breakfast when they're required, and 46% attend a school that still offers breakfast even if it's not required. And the math scores are much lower in schools that offer breakfast, right? But of course, these are much higher poverty schools. Right, so you wouldn't want to necessarily jump to this conclusion that, well, school breakfast is available and scores are lower. So instead, what I'm going to do is just to kind of give you some sense of where this is going, I'm going to just focus on schools that are close to these state thresholds. So plus or minus 5 percentage points of the threshold. And so this is going to be 93% of schools above these thresholds are going to offer breakfast versus 52%. So big increase. But now the test score signs are reversed, right? So these are still higher poverty schools by an average 5 percentage points higher percent free and reduced price eligible students. But the signs of the difference in test scores is flipped. Students. So this is small. And that's why I'm going to focus on math first, or NAEP first, sorry. So these are going to be really small. And so that's basically going to be the story, though. Oh, perfect. So these are actually quite large, right? So this is going to be, this difference is going to be about a third of the standard deviation. So just to give you a sense, of what happens if you just look at the distribution of student achievement of students above and below these thresholds. So this is going to be the distribution of students just above the state threshold where you're required to offer breakfast for math achievement. And this is going to be the distribution of students just below the state threshold where you're not required to offer breakfast. And so there's going to be a large increase at the left tail of the distribution, but also all throughout. So this is going to be kind of the idea. Ignore this up here, except I wanted to give you a sense of these specific thresholds, right? So these are going to range from 10 to 40%, and there's lots of different thresholds that states have used. What I'm going to try to do is this is the idea. I'm going to compare two states where both states have some requirement that students participate. And one state's going to have a 25% threshold, but another state is going to have a 35% threshold. And so the idea is going to be if you compare a state, a school that is at 20% and a school is at 30%, you're going to take the difference across the threshold in the state with the 25%, and the difference between 20 and 30% in the state where neither would be required. So there the threshold's still higher. So I'm just trying to difference within states and then across across poverty levels. And so what I'm going to find is that crossing these thresholds is going to lead to an 8% standard deviation increase in math achievement scores and a 5% increase in reading achievement scores. And if I try to then focus on schools that are closer to the threshold, the results are going to be reasonably similar. So just going to do one other thing, and that's going to be I'm going to try to focus a little bit more on schools right around the threshold through regression discontinuity design, and I'm actually going to find reasonably similar estimates for math. Right, so we have 9% of a standard deviation compared to here. The estimates range from 8 to 9%. For reading, it was about 5%, and now the estimates are going to run up to 12%. So I'll show you some graphs. They're kind of ugly, but this is what these estimates are. And so there's an idea that right at these thresholds, there's going to be an increase in reading achievement and an increase in math achievement. Now, you might worry about all sorts of things. I'm just going to briefly go through that, right? So one of the things you'd be worried about is these thresholds are known, so students, our school administrators could do all sorts of things. They could say, oh, the deadline for turning in your paperwork is October 2nd. Well, turns out you missed the threshold, so then we're not required to offer breakfast. Well, one of the things that's actually happened recently and during this time is there's now state they turn to figure out who's eligible. They turn to the state administrative roles for TANF and SNAP. So there's direct certification for who is eligible and who is not. And the idea behind that is that reduces the paperwork that parents have to go through to determine if they're eligible for school meal programs or not. And that's going to try to reduce some of this sorting around the threshold. But just in the interest of time, I'm going to skip most of that. And what I want to do is I want to show you these kind of ideas in the ECLSK data. So this is a much smaller data set where the idea is it's going to allow me to try to get some more information on what's occurring. And so this is just these different specifications where previously I found that crossing these state mandates increases math achievement by at least 9% of a standard deviation and reading achievement by at least 5% of a standard deviation. So what I'm going to find is that for math, actually a very similar estimate. So about 9% of a standard deviation, and for reading, 12% of a standard deviation. And that's going to be driven by a one-third increase in the likelihood of offering breakfast as a result of these state requirements. Right. So then you're going to scale these up to about a third of a standard deviation increase in reading and math. These are actually quite large, and so what I want you to keep in mind is that this is not a one-year effect, right? Because once the breakfast program goes into place in the school, it stays, right? So think of this as a throughout elementary school effect. You might be worried about all sorts of things. I just want to show you that there wasn't increases in school entrance tests. And what I want to do is I want to focus on a little bit of why this might be occurring. All right, so this is kind of a busy table, but so let me just show you what this is trying to do is it's trying to say, is this really coming about because of nutrition? Is it coming about, and then I'm going to try to get a sense of, is this coming about because of attendance? Why might there be an influence on academic outcomes or these cognitive measures? So parents are reporting how often the students are eating breakfast at home. And it doesn't seem to be the case that this is actually changing whether or not you eat breakfast. So this is actually consistent with some of the prior work that this isn't actually, at least in the last 20 years, this is not changing, not reducing breakfast skipping. So the story is going to be what it's doing is it's actually changing just what you eat for breakfast. So it's all about relative gains related to consumption. And so what you see are these increases in things like milk consumption. So students are asked, how many servings of milk do you have per week? Ideally, not the best information, but it's the information that we have available. And it's actually better than parent reports. So what we see is we see increases in milk consumption. We see reductions in soda consumption. We see increases in fruit consumption. So this is actually consistent, right? So the menu I showed you, and that's across the board, a choice of milk is offered. You're not allowed to offer soda. So soda consumption is about one soda per day. So that reduces it quite a bit. And fruit consumption increases. Not really a change in solid consumption. All this is consistent with the idea that you're influencing nutrition at school and in a way that is improving nutritional content. And so I'm going to just go through that in the interest of time, but to say that it doesn't really seem like it's an attendance effect. Right? So I'm able to look at information on unexcused and excused absences and excused tardies. It doesn't really seem to be the case that it's driven by absences and tardies. It seems to be more of a nutritional story with the limited nutritional information I have. But so the idea, just to kind of summarize some key points, breakfast has become increasingly available in schools. So since 1966, particularly since permanent authorization of the school breakfast program in 1975, breakfast has increased quite a bit, especially relative to lunch. And particularly after additional funding and state mandates that occurred in the early 1990s. So then this question of, do these state mandates actually do what they were intended to do, and do they influence whether or not the school breakfast program is offered? The answer seems to be yes, and by at least 33 percentage points. There's actually quite high compliance, which I think is just interesting in itself. So many other things have quite low compliance. So then, does the availability of the breakfast program influence cognitive achievement? The answer seems to be yes, and the results, I think, are most robust for math. Evidence supports the story for reading and science. The large results due to this is the impact throughout elementary school, and there's suggestive evidence that it doesn't change, at least in the last 20 years. The stories that are 10 years, the story is that it doesn't change whether or not you eat breakfast, it just changes what you eat for breakfast. And so I want you to think about the anecdotes that I hear all the time that are never going to make it into a paper are the idea that what it's doing is it's changing, you're not having Coke and Doritos for breakfast, you're having milk and some fruit substance. So that's kind of the idea. Now I can't rule out income or peer effects as well. But that's kind of the story of what I think has been happening to the school breakfast program. And with that, I'd like to say thanks.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.